Welcome to the Misophonia Podcast. This is the 10th episode of Season 3. My name's Adil Ahmad, and I have misophonia. This week, I'm talking to Jess. This was recorded not long after the most recent Misophonia convention, and Jess had just attended it online. She talks about that sort of high you get when you just come out of meeting lots of people like you who have misophonia, which is kind of what happens after a convention like this. We talk about all the struggles she's had trying to communicate misophonia to the people around her as a child, through friendships, relationships, and work. Few people really acknowledged and accepted what she's gone through until recently, but she's marched on and has a great job and life at the moment. Her story is that story of perseverance that we all kind of have to go through. On that note, just want to say that interviews for next season, season 4, will happen in March, and you can sign up right now through the Be a Guest link on the website, misophoniapodcast.com. I'll also have a direct link in the show notes. They're already starting to fill up, and I'm sure this will just accelerate after the holidays, so please grab a slot now if you want to talk about your story. I can't wait to record again. There are already some great episodes lined up from all over the world. And these happen over Zoom. They're super casual. No need to prepare for anything in advance. All right, now, let's get right into this week's episode with Jess. Jess, good to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, would you like to kind of find out about kind of where you're located?
I'm in Portland, Oregon. I know you've had a lot of guests from there already, but I guess we flock here, I suppose.
Yeah. You know, it's a lot of interesting stuff going on in Portland these days. And did you know Elise? Elise is based there, and she kind of is pretty active in the misophonia community.
I actually didn't have too much of a connection to the community until this past weekend when I finally went to the conference.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Zoom, okay. You signed up. Right. So you were in some of the sessions that I believe I was in at the conference, right? And that's where probably where you signed up. Cool. All right. Good. Yeah. Good to have somebody from the conference. Great. Okay. And So I guess you want to tell me a little bit about yourself. Like, are you working? Are you a student?
I'm 29 years old. I work in Portland. I am working remotely right now from home because of the pandemic, obviously, but we still haven't returned to the offices, so I'm still at home.
Do you want to talk about, like, kind of what type of work you do?
Yeah, sure. I do, inventory analysis in using Power BI a lot. I work for a company that does a lot of retail and has a really strong communication or a connection to the healthcare industry and credit cards and banking and things like that. So the services company.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, you're working from home. You're still there. Are you guys going to be going back to the office anytime soon, or is it kind of still TBD?
I think it's up to, I think it's just up to the powers that be in Portland until further notice. I haven't gotten much information on how we're going to reintegrate back into the building and into teams at large. As you can tell, I don't get a lot of interactions with people over Zoom or meetings.
Yeah.
I pretty much only talk to my boss every day, and that's about it.
Yeah. So how's it been then? Was it a relief to get out of the office in some ways? Or is it pretty, is it not too bad in terms of MISO where you were working?
So nobody at work knows about my misophonia, and I keep it pretty hush-hush generally, but especially at work. I did have a desk where I sat right next to my boss and right across a cubicle divider from another two people that I work with. And a long time ago, probably early 2020, I asked to switch desks because of the misophonia.
Yeah.
And I kind of used a different excuse for it. I actually, last year, around this time, I went to a sleep specialist mm-hmm. for this like problem I was having. I was falling asleep in the daytime all the time, and I've had this issue since like teenage years. Yeah. But one of my friends finally convinced me to go to a sleep specialist. So I got a sleep study done and found out that I have like idiopathic hypersomnia, which doesn't really mean much, but I fall asleep a lot, and basically used that as my excuse and told my boss that I needed to that I wanted to be kind of in my own corner of the room so that I could kind of set the alarm when I needed to.
Oh,
so that every once in a while I get a little bit of a jolt. Yeah.
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 And what did your boss say then? Was fine? Or whatever you need to do?
Yeah. I don't think he really understood what I was asking for, but eventually I got my new desk and it was fine, and we haven't talked about it at all since. So, I'm in a really good, like, I mean, when we were in the office, I'm far away from everyone else. I'm at least 5 feet away from everyone. So even a little bit COVID friendly if we were to go back. But I got a lot of questions from coworkers about why I moved. And so I just had this like pre-rehearsed spiel about this needing to set an alarm like every hour or whatever on the hour to just gave that to everyone I work with.
Oh, interesting. So, that's the first time I've, Oh, and by the way, did you happen to use like any ADA, the ADA laws at all? Or was it just, I've got this thing and I kind of need to be on this, you know, be at a separate desk?
I didn't actually have to. My boss wasn't really, I don't have a ton of interaction with other people normally in my job. It's pretty autonomous, so when I need to talk to my boss, one of us would just get up from our desks and walk over to the other. So, and we were always doing that. There's very little excuse to get up from your desk otherwise, and we like to walk around and stuff, so it was pretty easy, and I think he really didn't think twice about it, probably. So.
Yeah. So one question I have, and I don't mean this in a I hope this doesn't come off wrong, but a lot of people are, they're wondering about, they're kind of nervous about telling their boss or whatever about misophonia because it's, it's not usual. But it seems like you decided to not deal with the miso and you went with a condition that's arguably even rarer or even more kind of or also maybe at least equally unusual as the kind of like permanent as the reason that you told your boss about, and then it's also now the spiel that you have to tell your coworkers. This is kind of interesting that these are two things that are I could see people with each of them each of those conditions kind of wanting to hide one, but you chose not miso. Is there a reason maybe that you chose that and you didn't want to talk about miso?
I'll give you the honest truth here. I didn't actually apply for the job that I have now. I applied for a different job in the same team with the same boss, and went through a couple of like trial meetings with him and another person. And these meetings would last, and that's before I got this job. I think they were trying to vet me to see if it was like a good fit or something. But these meetings were so long and not necessarily exciting or scary. So I was falling asleep constantly in those meetings. So I was like, I'm pretty sure he's going to think this is inarguable no matter what. I don't have to like... I'm pretty sure he's seen me fall asleep many times over, especially because we used to sit next to each other. So I was like, I'll just make the obvious one.
Okay, interesting. So Okay, so you had strong suspicion that you were kind of notorious sleeper, and so it would be kind of an easier thing for them to swallow. Okay.
Yeah.
If I may rephrase it in that way, but
definitely. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, it was just interesting that some people might think that the sleeping thing is a more odd, quote unquote, thing to use an excuse. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But yeah, that's
yeah.
There was some history there, and so you just had to go with the with the sleep issue. Okay, and that's cool.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder to hide too.
Yeah, right. So then, okay, so you got some distance now from your coworkers. I mean, were they, were they triggering you quite a bit, or and that led you to move over? I forgot. Maybe you mentioned that, but I just got distracted by the sleeping story.
Oh no, you're fine. No worries. Yes, I very much did. I had a lot of triggers at work. I was sitting at that time, like a foot away from my, or maybe like 2 or 3 feet from my boss, 2 or 3 feet from another guy that sat across the cubicle from me, and then there was somebody kitty corner to me, and they all had their own different varying triggers for me. Yeah. I mean, my boss would like snack a lot, and the guy across the street or across the aisle from me would tap his foot constantly, and then I had the guy kitty corner from me who would I forgot what his was. I think it was pen clicking or some other sort of thing like that. That's pretty common.
Right.
For people, but
either way, yeah, it sounded like I mean, even one of those things you had to move. And so now that you're far away, now that you're further away, is it do you still have to wear like headphones and stuff, or is it pretty manageable?
I do wear headphones. When I was in the office, I was wearing headphones all the time anyway, even in the new seat, because I can still hear things. I mean, I'm not close to anybody, so it's not right in my ear, but I tend to hone in on it, even if I am in the vicinity of the trigger sound. So
exactly, yeah.
I listen to, lots of music, podcasts a lot. Just anything that I can sort of, any varietal tones or sounds that I can put right in my ear that are preferable to what's going on around me is what I use. So a lot of that. But
any visual triggers around the office?
Not anymore. I have I've got my laptop and 2 monitors at work in the office. So, and those are like pretty big. So they kind of block out anybody, and I don't notice somebody coming up until they're like right up on me. But
yeah,
no,
you just get those big, big BI graphs going, and just surrounding your field of vision.
Yeah, it's a little easier to concentrate with those things in front of you. You know, so much detail. Yeah. But I do have working from home. I've gotten a lot of. I've started getting some more of the visual things that I kind of had before, like in childhood and stuff, but like my partner, he bites his nails sometimes, and so I can kind of tell what went out of the corner of my eye. I see him starting to go for it, and I'm like, oh no, what's about to happen? What am I going to do?
Do you tell him?
Yeah, we are working on that. We've talked about this issue a couple of different times. I've only brought it up to, I think, one other partner before. And I had a really long relationship before that where there was no triggers happening with that person ever until, the last 2 relationships. And this one... has been particularly understanding. He's very receptive to people in general. I've noticed he's like a very, is very enthusiastic about like learning about people, about understanding them. And it seems like no amount of things that I can say that might cause him more work or turning him away. Like there's nothing I could do. I feel like that he would be like, oh, I don't know if I want to be with you anymore for that. I feel like I've thrown so much at him, especially with the misophonia, that and he just
and the constant and sleeping while he's talking to you and
yeah, it's not quite that severe, but yeah, he's been a pretty remarkable person to have on my side of this. Like, he's just been very willing to hear about it, very willing to talk about it. He asked questions. Yeah, so I think I got extraordinarily lucky with this one.
That's great. And obviously until he goes at his nails, but it sounds like you probably, does he catch himself, or do you have to, now that you've talked about it with him, or do you have to still nudge him a bit or slap him?
I have to nudge him a bit. The nail biting thing, like, I think it wasn't a trigger for me until I met him. And he only started doing that pretty recently. So when I brought it up, I felt a little bit weird about it because it wasn't something we had talked about before with regards to misophonia. We had talked about, like, eating sounds and things like that, but the nail biting was new, and I guess I didn't really know how to handle it, so I don't think I did very well. So we're still working on the nail biting thing, but he seems to be, like, trying very hard not to do it. But yeah, so sometimes I'll just, like, shoot him a glance and
yeah, we know that. And by you know, by not handling it very well, have you ever, like, lashed out at this partner or maybe other partners at maybe being triggered?
I don't think I've lashed out at them. My thing is the flight is my initial response.
Yeah.
I get angry when I'm trapped, but if
and
I can get up and
out.
Leave, it's, yeah. And he knows, we have this, like, he knows about this, and I've told him that when we're eating or when we're in the car sometimes with each other, I'll wear an earplug on his side of wherever I am, we're like an earplug in my left ear if he's driving the car and we're in the car for a while and we're eating and snacking on a road trip or something.
And if you switch drivers, you got to move the earplug over to the other side. And
I do, yeah. I'm actually constantly moving from one ear to the other, and sometimes I usually have two on me, so I've taken these, like, foam, you know, those foam earplugs that are really squishy.
I've
taken those and I cut them in half, and then I have double the amount of earplugs, and then they're so small that I can fit them in my little pocket or a keychain holder thingy. And I just have them with me all the time, and they're very easily looked over. Like, people, it takes a bit for people to notice that they're there.
Right.
Because they're so small.
Yeah, do you find earplugs work well? I mean, they lower the sound, but obviously the sound is still there. And if you're the type that kind of maybe hones in on things, does that bother you still, or it's proportionally less?
Most of the time, when I'm hearing something that when I'm hearing a trigger sound, I've got the earplug in on that side, and I usually, it muffles it enough where the sound isn't distinct. I think most of my triggers are, like, clicking, kind of. Like, when I can hear the spit in somebody's mouth moving around, or when I can hear them, like, smacking their foods. It's that really high pitch, like, sharp. And so the earplugs work really well because they're muffling everything.
Yeah, they cut the high frequency really well, so.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, I love that for that.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll come back to we'll come back to work and maybe some of your other previous partners. But I wanna maybe go back in time to kind of early days for you, and maybe around when you feel like it started, or you started noticing it.
I started noticing it, like, probably junior high age, with my mom, around the dinner table. Mostly, and I just remember kind of always dreading dinners. And we always had dinner as a family at the table, and it was always quiet. we weren't really like the kind of family that like played music or had football on in the background or anything like that. So there was nothing else to focus on. And I remember just being absolutely feeling just inundated with this, the most of the, like just the worst of the trigger sounds with the eating and the chewing and the, and stuff like that. But it was, it was pretty hard. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, no, I was going to say, like, was it a big family? I know it started with your mom, but were there other people around as well that were potential triggers?
There were, I mean, we have a small family. It's just me, my sister, and then I have my mom and my dad. And I remember not thinking of the trigger sounds in terms of my dad or my sister, only with my mom for a very long time. And then when I vaguely remember saying something to my mom about it, just sort of casually saying, hey, mom, you're kind of snacking your food. Can you maybe not do that at the dinner table? And then that not obviously working because it takes time to, like, sort of undo a habit or a way of, like, eating, you know, that is so innate to our human nature. And then mentioning it later to her privately and talking, it became like a thing in our family. And I don't know that it was necessarily like in my sister's realm of awareness too much, but I remember thinking that it would almost get worse with my dad after I had mentioned it. And I don't know if that was like, I used to feel like it was intentional, but I'm sure it was. I doubt it was. He's not like that, but I remember feeling like, oh, now that I've mentioned it, it's getting so much worse. Because they used to tell me to, you know, kind of tune it out, or, you know, you got to learn to block that stuff out, or, you know, not focus on it or something like that. And I remember wishing so badly that if only I could just think differently about this or reframe it, or if I could just wish this away, I would. But I remember just not being able to communicate that very well to my parents, that I couldn't, and that this was a thing. And
so you mentioned it, so you were being initially triggered by your mom. You mentioned it to kind of your whole family, or at least your parents. And then, did you sit them down kind of thing? Or was it like, you know, you want to, or at the dinner table kind of thing?
You know, I don't remember.
Was there a lot of prep for it, or was it more spontaneous?
I remember taking a long time to even mention it. In my inner monologue, I was having a problem, like kind of sussing out, how do I want to say this? What will it come out like? What is this going to sound like? How is it going to be received? And then what wasn't so great of a reception, I don't remember, I definitely didn't sit them down, and I would have probably, I'm guessing what happened is we had a small conversation about it at the dinner table one night, and I didn't get the kind of response that I was hoping for, and then probably just backing off, and the next, like, I don't know how long. I think I moved out when I was like 22, 21. I, you know, until then, I was probably stuffing little pieces of cotton ball in my ear just to muffle the sound, and because that's all I knew of. I mean, when you're a kid, you're pretty much looking for anything, and it's hard to like ask for or know when to ask for help, like professional help.
Yeah.
So I never saw an audiologist until my adulthood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting that you, even at that young age, you were intentional about wanting to talk to them about it. And you were, thinking about, you had an inner monologue going, like, how are you going to talk about it? You know, as opposed to a lot of kids at that age just don't know what's going on, and they're lashing out and whatnot. So it was important enough to you that you were wanting to talk about it with your parents. And, And I guess, did you end up, did you end up seeing an audiologist or a therapist or anything about it at any time until you kind of moved out?
I saw a couple of
You have Dr. Johnson in Portland.
Yes, yeah. I didn't see her until last year.
Wow.
So I wasn't even diagnosed with misophonia until last year professionally. And I remember before then, as an adolescent, talking to my mom about it enough where she's a very curious person, and she reads a lot, and she just wants to know all the things. So she saw like a 50 minutes or 50, one of those shows had an episode about a man who was a father, and they did a like show about how he one day was mowing the lawn and suddenly he was experiencing pain from hearing his children's laughter. And my mom, I remember her pointing this out, and she was like, we should watch this together. I think this might be related to that problem you have. And she would just call it like sensitive hearing. But I think that got us a little bit, watching that together got us a little bit closer, and me a little bit closer to being able to identify it. And it wasn't until like I saw, it wasn't until then that I think I started having it on my radar as the selective sound sensitivity syndrome, and then probably a couple years ago, learning about the word misophonia and thinking, okay, that's probably what it is. And then much, much later, moving to Portland and finding Dr. Johnson and finally being able to identify it indefinitely. And I remember after seeing Dr. Johnson, I went back to my car and got in and just bawled.
Yep.
The relief at being able to slap a label on this and say, it's not just me, and there are people that are dedicating their careers to studying this, it's legitimate, is indescribable.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying there. And yeah, I think a lot of listeners do. When you find out what it is, you think back to like all those moments at the dinner table and all the effects that has on your life. And all the pain, all the painful moments that you deal with. So yeah, it's a big revelation. Were you kind of I guess you just found out about miso. You had just had the Dr. Johnson appointment last year, but were you kind of like doing little bits of research on sound sensitivity over the years?
Every time.
And then you found Dr. Johnson?
No, actually, so that's not how I found Dr. Johnson. It's funny. So I at any time in the last like decade that I would be quote unquote researching misophonia, I was in like a state of absolute stress and despair already from having an episode of being just bombarded with trigger sounds. And then I would go on my phone, I'd finally be able to step away or get away for a second, and I would look at my phone or my computer and just like frantically typing away at Google, and just, you know, you're already in that state where you're just of full on sorrow that I probably only looked at online sources and things for maybe 20 minutes before like shutting it down right away. And when you first Google that stuff, sometimes it doesn't, the most helpful sources don't always come up first. So I had been missing so much because of that, because I hadn't taken a time period where I was, you know, really well resourced. I was fed. I was like not tired. I was out of work. I had free time and researching it. Like I had never done that. So if I had, I would have probably found a lot of the resources that I've found since well before that and been better off. But it wasn't until I was seeing a therapist in Portland, actually, who does a lot of work in cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, she is the best therapist I've ever had, and I owe so much to her. But she was, I started talking to her about this, and she independently, on her free time, started researching misophonia. She wanted to understand it. She wanted to know more about it. She asked me a lot of questions, but then outside of our session, she would look it up herself, and she found the conference. And she found, I believe she's the one that found Dr. Johnson for me and recommended that I, you know, this is something you could look into if you like. You know, I'll just leave this for you. Or, you know, she's got all these resources, and she'll like email me things like, hey, I read this interesting thing, or I heard this interesting thing on a podcast, or I saw this, and she'll just email me on her free time. It's amazing. Yeah. And I've never, and she's been working with me a lot on misophonia lately. And she actually, it's amazing. And she actually found Shadi, and who's also in Portland and specializes in misophonia. She found Dr. Shadi. I only became familiar with her over the weekend, so I apologize. I don't remember her last name. She found her, and they talked, and they had, they spent time together, and Shadi, explained misophonia to my therapist, and they're like actively working on this together. And it's just, it really does wonders to have somebody who is completely in your corner without judgment whatsoever. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's gotta, that's gotta be a huge relief. And I mean, I've heard a lot of people come on here and talk about how they're, you know, the therapists are totally dismissive, or you know, they may have already heard about it, but they misdiagnose you. But this is the best therapists are the ones that, you know, will go actually do their research like yours did. And this is like another level where she's kind of like hitting you up on your free time and getting together with, to learn about it with other therapists. That's fantastic. What are some of the things that she's working with you on to try to manage your misophonia?
So she spent time with Shadi last week. I meet with my therapist once a week. So I actually won't talk with her until tomorrow. But so far, she's asked me a lot of questions about sort of the, how it feels to be in sort of in this, in that very high stress moment. And we've talked a lot about the fight or flight response and what's going on in the brain when you have a very extraordinary stressful event like that. So we've talked a lot about that so far. She's been awesome.
That's great. And, going back, you would do over the years, you would do these like quick bits of research while you were super stressed out. What were kind of the typical situations you were in that were stressing you out? Were there all kind of work environments or outside in the world, on the bus? Was it kind of all over the place, or was there some troubled places that were really getting you?
Most of it is, I've had a couple of breakdowns after meetings where I've had to be in a room with someone or two people that are eating. And I still haven't been like brave enough, I guess you could say, to ask that they don't eat in a meeting. It seems like a reasonable enough ask to me, but I just haven't yet. I'm just really scared, I guess. But mostly, mostly it's like right after I'm like trapped in an environment where I can't get away, where it would be like socially, where I wonder if it would be socially acceptable to ask that they stop making the noise or point it out. where I'm too embarrassed to say anything, and so I'm just sitting there trapped, like, and maybe, you know, sometimes I've gotten, like, during work meetings, I'll get up and I'll excuse myself and probably have people assume that I'm getting my computer charger or something like that, and I'll run to my desk and grab my little foam earplugs, and then I'll read lips for the rest of the meeting, but, yeah, those are the those are the worst moments for me, is usually when people are just eating around me.
Yeah, and being trapped. I mean, I think one way that helps when you're around people who are eating is just realizing that there is a, just scoping out where the exit door is, or and just kind of like watching how, you know, how long is it going to take before they're done. Like, it's you know, having like physical and kind of temporal escapes, knowing when things will be done, knowing how you can get out of it. But if you feel trapped, like you're in that meeting and you have to pay attention, that's terrible. What about your friends? Do you tell your friends about misophonia? And how soon do you tell them? I'm just curious how you deal with your social circles.
I haven't told most of my friends. I only actually, following the conference weekend, I saw two of my friends in person after that, and was just absolutely flying, like just so excited to, just very jazzed about the entire weekend, about how everything went, about all the people that I met and chatted with, and all of the just the sheer amount of numbers that like showed up and said, I want to know more about this, I have this, or I'm an ally and I'm here to talk about it. And was just so...
It is a surreal thing to go to. You should go to the... I recommend going to the in-person one, too. It's just, it's a whole other surreal level. Anyways, sorry, continue. Yeah, you met up with a couple of your friends after.
Yeah, I was just so excited. I couldn't hold it in anymore. I was like, I need to talk to you about neuroplasticity and misophonia and all these amazing people that I met. And I told them, and they were just... reacted exactly as I probably could have expected them to. They've always been extraordinarily accepting people, and that's exactly how they were. They asked a lot of questions. They said, oh, I'm so sorry you went through, you go through this when it's really difficult for you. Is there anything we can do to help? Naturally, they asked if they ever are triggered.
Triggers, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it was a great conversation, and it was super easy, and yeah, I have really supportive friends. I found in Portland, you can pretty much say, you can provide somebody with information about you that is maybe a little bit off the wall, and no matter what it is, people are going to be pretty accepting.
Yeah, Portland's a pretty open city. No, that's cool. I'm curious, like, what would you, what kind of like kept you from telling your friends before? Was it just kind of your just natural, you know, not necessarily wanting to tell everybody about everything until you have to, or?
Yeah, pretty much. I've always been a little bit nervous about, kind of spilling secrets, I guess, or personal details about myself, but I think just the way my parents initially reacted, that it wasn't real, like, it just taken a long time for me to sort of validate this to myself, let alone share how valid this is with other people.
How are your parents now? Like, your dad, I haven't heard from about your dad in a while. Is I know your mom gave you showed you the 2020. Are they... Are they more accepting now and understanding and accommodating?
No accommodation necessarily. I think it's just a matter of, you really can't, I mean, it's hard to change people's natural behaviors. But my mom and I talk a lot more about personal things than I would with my dad. It's just kind of how I'm kind of a mama's girl, I guess, but she's very willing to talk about it. I actually talked to her about it after the conference as well. And she was more than willing to like hear more about it, hear what I learned. I think she's interested in the brain science behind different things we learned about treatments and that over the weekend. My dad and I don't talk about it at all. We haven't since. I don't think we ever, he and I directly talked about it openly. But that's okay.
What about your sister?
My sister, no, not at all. Not at all. When that was all happening, she was probably like on her way out of high school and going to college, and she went to another state to go to college. So I didn't have we didn't have like a really close relationship until adulthood, until we were both out until we were both out of school. And
you know, I guess something I ask, I can't believe the holidays are going to be a little bit different this year, but do you have any things you do when you get together with your family now to kind of like make things a little bit easier for you, like eat quickly, volunteer in the kitchen, or you know, go for a walk outside? I'm sure people are planning their they might be happy to stay home and not travel, but some people might still be trapped with a large family.
I mean, no matter what, I think during a large meal like that, when it's like extended, even if we're at home and it's just my partner and I, he and I will probably still have like a lot of food and have it be like an extended all day eating fest. I'll pretty much have my earplugs in all day.
Got it. So you'll do the earplugs when you eat with your partner. You got earplugs on? Like, is that pretty standard?
Yeah.
Okay. What other kind of tools? So earplugs, headphones. I guess there aren't really any other like little tricks and tools. But do you have any other kind of things that you do or things that make sure are around? To kind of deal with this.
I hate to plug Amazon, but I found through that website some little earplugs, or not earplugs, there is a company called Eargasm that
I've heard of that.
They make some pretty good earplugs that are clear, and those will muffle the sound the same as the ones I use do, but they're a little bit itchy because they're like silicone or rubber or something. Those are pretty good. They're for concert goers, and they're moderately hard to see from an outsider's point of view. If they're looking at your ear, they're probably not going to notice it. I like those for going like out to dinners if I'm doing that. Through Amazon, I have these like little palm-sized case, but they're tiny little Bluetooth earbuds made by a company called Syros, Syros, and I love them so much. Mm-hmm. They're not invisible, so that is a problem. You can't wear them in meetings while you're talking to your boss, but they're great for at work. They're not as easy to see, and they have a pretty long battery life, and they can be loud.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I really like those. These are my favorite things.
Yeah. I haven't heard of that one, but I'll definitely look that up. Cool. Well, this has been good. We're kind of hitting around, or I don't know, 45 minute mark. I'm curious, you just came out of that it's been almost a week, but hopefully you're still on the high. I know I usually am coming out of the conference. Do you have anything you want to tell people about Misophonia, about yourself, any people who are listening to the show?
Not in particular. I think it's just immeasurably important to have I think therapy is extraordinary. Won't solve your problems, mm-hmm. but it will get you to sort of understand yourself way better than you would otherwise might be able to. It gives you a lot of tools to sort of coping and recovering from stressful situations, which I think is really important. And if you find an excellent therapist, then you're golden, and they're going to help you with sources that maybe they can't provide. And I also really can't recommend enough having a partner that is empathetic toward all your little oddities, you know, being able to tell somebody something that you might be, you know, afraid to tell is really important. Having somebody that's very accepting like that is awesome. And especially with friendships, I would think, because, I mean, anybody that you're spending a lot of time with, it's important for them to be able to understand you. And Dr. Johnson actually has these, sometimes she recommended to me, and I think she spoke about this during the conference, these ear hearing aids that can transmit Bluetooth to your phone and different sounds and music and things like that. I think those are really cool and a great option for people if they're in school or work where they're constantly being in front of trigger sounds or potential moments where they'll have to hear trigger sounds and can't avoid them. That's really cool. And I think she takes appointments, if I'm not mistaken, through Zoom now, but I'm not entirely sure, but I'm sure she'd be willing to help. Yeah. And I think music can do can make a world of difference too. I know some people have, they do find triggers in music, but I think sometimes you, like, at least for me, music is really helpful, having like a variety of tones and instruments and frequencies in a single song can kind of unravel the jumbled, like, stress ball that is misophonia.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's good to have songs that actually, another tip is to have songs that start right away. The worst thing is like you're fumbling for some music and it takes 30 seconds to build up.
Yeah.
I've definitely been through that. I know that's really great. And I like your tip on the therapist, because yeah, but if somebody gets to the point of wanting to invest in a therapist, it's good to know what kind of the expectations are, what they're going to give you. It'll be probably more about, at this point when there's no cure, it'll be more about coping with those, getting back to zero, getting back to normal, basically how to manage post trigger, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Maybe a little pre too, but anyways, yeah. And an audiologist like Dr. Johnson is great at, is great if you need to be prescribed those. I think it's like Widex is one of the companies that makes those hearing devices.
Oh, yeah.
Option. Well, cool. Yeah, Jess. Well, yeah. Thanks again. Thanks again for coming on. Yeah, it was good to virtually meet you at the convention. Hopefully we'll all get together in wherever it's going to be next year. But
yeah,
it's always a good time. So,
indeed,
yeah,
yeah,
thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Thanks for producing this. This is really meaningful. I really appreciate all the effort and energy and emotional energy that you put into this. It's amazing.
Thank you, Jess. Hope to see more of you at the convention next year. But at least please consider coming onto the podcast. Remember that interview slots are opened up for March. Grab one today. If you're enjoying the shows, please hit the 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us kind of get recommended in other people's feeds. Otherwise, hit me up on Instagram or Facebook at Misophonia Podcast, or on Twitter at Misophonia Show. Music, as always, is by Moby. And until next week, wishing you peace.